And tonight we're going beyond Area 51 with Mac Maloney, an incredible story, secret bases out there. We'll be checking in with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Let me tell you about Mac Maloney. Mac was with us about a year ago, by the way, talking about his work, UFOs and wartime, author of numerous military adventure novels. Mac received a bachelor's degree in journalism at Suffolk University and a master's degree in film at Emerson College. He is a contributing writer for TrueTV.com and a member of the rock band Sky Club. How about that? Mac, welcome. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. I'm looking forward to this, and your work has just been superb. It really is. How did you get interested in the field of these UFOs and Area 51 from a military writing background?
Well, you know, Area 51 comes up a lot when you're writing about military fiction these days. We know that the U.S. government or the U.S. military does testing of secret aircraft out there, mostly reconnaissance craft, and they do a lot of special operations training out there as well. So it's just something that just naturally comes to you through the research when I'm doing my military fiction books.
Well, good for you. And, you know, when you were on with us back in 2012 when you talked about UFOs in wartime, that was a riveting story because I had always heard, Mac, stories of pilots seeing these little Foo Fighters and these very strange things. Lots of things have been going on this planet for a long, long time, haven't they?
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about it, especially in World War II, as you say, people just thought of them as puffs of smoke, puffs of light. Foo Fighters, I think, was a name that kind of it didn't really give them the full weight of what was going on. But as it turns out, when you look into it, that lots of pilots on all sides, Allied, German, and Japanese, saw these, what we would call flying saucers, UFOs, what we call them today. They saw them all during World War II, over Europe and over the Pacific Theater. So it was much more involved than I ever thought it would be.
We've got a great trailer that Mac gave us. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Go take a look at it, of some of his work. And, you know, as we look at this entire field of ufology and these secret bases that we'll get into, Mac, and they're worldwide, they're not just Area 51, it tells you that government has known something for a very long time, but I don't think they're working in tandem with any of these ET possibilities. I think they're doing it on their own. What do you think?
I agree with you. I don't think that there is any kind of connection between the militaries of the planet and ETs. I know a lot of people believe that or like to believe it. I know a lot of books and so on have been written about it. I'm just of the mind that the U.S. military, they know more about UFOs than they're letting on. But I don't really think they know the secret of UFOs, and I don't think that they're acting in concert with ETs. I think it's just much more deeper than that.
Now, this latest book, Beyond Area 51, you did a lot of research for it. There's some talk that you were helped by some U.S. intelligence agency or employee. What's going on there?
Well, that's actually true. Somebody that I know that I grew up with in Boston, I've known since grade school, we went separate ways. I became a writer, and he went to work for U.S. Army intelligence, and then after that went to work for the U.S. intelligence agencies. And he knew that I was working on UFOs in wartime, so when I told him that I was going to do a follow-up book, I just asked him if he would just kind of guide me through it, if I could send him drafts of each chapter as I wrote it, and if he saw anything in there that was just going too far afield, would he let me know? So that's the arrangement that we have. In fact, the book starts off with he and I having a couple beers, and it ends the same way. But someone says he's kind of like Marley's ghost following me through the Christmas Carol, and it's not quite that, but he is kind of over my shoulder looking to make sure that what I put in the book wasn't, you know, really too far afield, and you know, I think that it made it a better read.
Without revealing too much, too, on his end.
Well, see, he couldn't. That's the thing.
Yeah.
That, you know, he had to stay anonymous, obviously.
Hey, what did you think of the Boston Globe getting sold, by the way?
Getting sold?
Yeah, the owner of the Red Sox bought them.
Well, it's going to be Red Sox 24/7 with the Boston Globe.
It just might be. Has the Globe been very supportive of strange and unusual stories, or do they just pass on that?
No, they just pass on them. They're a little too They think they're mainstream, a little high-minded for it, let's say. But
yeah.
The Boston Herald, which is the other newspaper in Boston, is they'd be more apt to do things on UFOs and stories of that nature. It's a much better newspaper.
Now, as you started writing the book, Beyond Area 51, in highlighting on some of the places, what was some of the first secret bases that you were able to unravel?
Well, we tried to find the first secret base, and, you know, it's hard to find secret bases, as we found out, because they're secret. But the first secret base, we think, is a place called Megiddo, and I might be pronouncing that wrong, but it's an ancient city. It's in northern Israel, and it was really the first city in the civilized world. In 3000 BC, when people were still more or less living in settlements, Megiddo was a huge metropolis, and what it was people kept building cities on top of layer by layer by layer. It was on a very strategic route between Egypt and Assyria. And so it built up and built up and built up until it was a mountain. And on top of this mountain, they put a fortress. And what they used to do is they engineered it so water would flow into this fortress. They engineered it so they were able to build stables for their horses and barracks for their soldiers, all within the walls of this huge city. And so what they were doing was they were hiding the true strength of their military from their enemies. And that's what a secret base is. A secret base is where you want to hide, you know, your best weapons, your true strength from your enemy. So Megiddo was really, we feel, the first secret base. And what's unusual about it is that it is the Hebrew word for hill is Har, and so the real name of this place was Har Megiddo, and if you look throughout the history of it, it turns out that is actually pronounced as Armageddon, and that's really the place where the Bible says the final battle is going to take place. But our research just said that Megiddo was probably the first secret base in history, 3000 B.C.
Of course, in those days, they didn't have satellite cameras, peering down on them as we do now.
Right, and the higher you went, the better off you were.
That's true. That's true. So, you know, with the bases today, like Area 51, you write about one in Russia that could be in the mountains. Mm-hmm. I assume they're hiding things underground, aren't they?
A lot of things are hidden underground these days. Actually, in Russia, at Yamato Mountain, there's this vast, huge underground base that was built in the 90s. And I think it's more of a place where the top people in the Russian government would go in case there was some kind of a nuclear event. But, you know, the days of putting something up high to hide it from your enemies, you know, doesn't work anymore because, as you said, we have satellite photos, photography available these days. So putting it underground is really the place. If you want to really put something large, hide it from your enemy, put it underground.
How would they do that, Mac? I mean, would they have, for example, if they've got a specialized plane that they've made, how do they put it underground?
Well, I'm not sure if too many airplanes are actually put underground or secret airplanes. What they do at Area 51 is basically pull them out onto the runway when they know Russian satellites aren't going over, and then when they know the satellites are going over, they put them back into a hangar. But I have heard from people who live out in that area that, and you've probably heard this too, that, you know, sometimes people say that they see airplanes, large airplanes, coming right out of the mountains in Nevada. So if the U.S. military is some huge equivalent to the Batcave or something out there,
might be
possible.
What did you think of the stories of Bob Lazar?
Well, he's an interesting guy. And, of course, I heard of him when he first came into prominence in the late 80s when he was doing the first TV interviews about Area 51. And in many ways, he really put Area 51 on the map.
Literally, he did.
And yeah. And the stories that he was telling about S4, for instance, back then, you know, they were just, they were interesting from anyone's point of view. Anyone had any kind of passing, you know, interest in UFOs. But the more we kind of looked into it, and we talked to a number of people who actually knew him, and the one story that we came upon, and we're not the first people to say this, but the idea is that maybe he was someone who was actually a U.S. disinformation agent all along. And the whole idea was, as I was just saying, when they are testing aircraft at Area 51, they have to be ready for Russian satellites to go over, and they know when they're coming over. So what they would do is they would have to put the airplane back in the hangar, wait for the satellite to go over, bring it back out, and then if the satellite had infrared capabilities, the Russians would actually be able to see the heat signature of this airplane on the runway, even after it had been brought into the hangar. So what I think they wanted to do was kind of take the heat off of Area 51 and maybe divert it somewhere else. So Bob comes out with his story, and that of this great facility at Papoose Lake, which is, you know, just about 20 minutes south of Area 51, and started talking about all these kind of exotic things going on there. And, you know, we came upon some evidence that the Russians did, in fact, start redirecting their satellites to take pictures of Papoose Lake and Papoose Mountain, and not as many as Area 51. So just from a logistics point of view, that helped out the people at Area 51 so they wouldn't have to, you know, schlep these planes in and out of the hangar all the time. Plus, we heard later on, and I think a lot of people know this too, that supposedly Bob is now doing business with the Defense Department. He has a little business that he sells kind of exotic items to the Defense Department. I just can't imagine the Defense Department working with him if the history that, as we know it, was true. So I'm feeling he might have been in a little more in cahoots with the government than was let on.
That's an interesting take. Yeah, he's got a small scientific equipment and supply company.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know who his clients are, but if he is indeed selling to the government, that's indeed strange, considering that he was a whistleblower, you know, mm-hmm. talking about ET craft and reverse engineering and things like that.
Right, right. I was told by two different people that he now does business with the Defense Department. So if that's true, then, you know, he's had an interesting history with the government.
Of course, knowing our government, they probably forgot who he was or something.
They did say they erased his, you know, his resume. So maybe that's
You know what? You know, some people, when they challenge his credibility, they've always said, look, there's no record that you went to this school or did that. But his supporters say, no, he was basically eliminated, erased, and all his records are gone. So you've got those two different camps out there, Mac. It's tough to believe, isn't it?
Well, it really is a mystery. And, you know, he doesn't really do any interviews or anything like that. So the closest we could get is talk to people who knew him back then. And they just say that he was always a very interesting guy. And if he was acting, he was a very good actor.
Our George Knapp, whom you know, was one of the first to interview Lazar a long, long time ago. Lots of strange things still happening on the planet. So give me your overall take, Mac, first of all, on what you think has been going on at Area 51.
Well, I really do think that it's primarily a place where the U.S. military, and specifically the Air Force, tests new aircraft, and mostly reconnaissance aircraft. That's what they've been doing there for years. We know that, for instance, the U-2 was tested there. The SR-71 Blackbird was tested there. Some of the stealth fighters were tested there, and some of the prototypes for the stealth fighter were tested there. We know that they do some special operations stuff out there, but, of course, we don't know specifically what it is. But, I mean, I've talked to pilots who have flown in and out of there, who have flown around it. I've talked to people who were there. And I believe, just for the most part, what is going on there is very, very deep, dark, black operations testing of military aircraft.
And I don't see anything wrong with that, for a nation to do that. I think you have to for a strong defense, don't you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And it's a place where it has to be secret. I mean, we say in the book that it's the most famous secret base in the world, and it is. Everyone knows about it. Everyone knows where it is. But when people say that they see, you know, very strange lights over it and so on, and as you know, you can't get very close to it anymore.
That's right.
I mean, that could just be that, you know, we are testing man-made aircraft that, you know, have all these just very unusual far-out capabilities. But, you know, we just don't know. And I think it's interesting, too, that when you hear all these government leaks, WikiLeaks and stuff, nothing ever leaks out of Area 51, which is interesting.
No, other than a few people like Lazar.
You're
right. Not much gets out there. What other areas, not only around this planet, but in the United States and then worldwide, are there that are strange like that?
Well, the most unusual place is actually about 100 miles north of Area 51. It's a place called Tonopah Air Force Base, or Tonopah Test Facility. That's where, for 10 years, the stealth fighter flew out of there for only at night. And no one knew about it. Only the people flying it, the people who worked at the base, and a few people who actually live in Tonopah, Nevada, which is a very small town nearby, knew that something interesting was going on there. And that it was so secret that for the stealth fighter to fly at night and go over the border of Nevada into California airspace had to have a special permission from the president. The stealth fighters have now left Tonopah. But something is out there. When you see Google Sky satellite photos of the place, all this Russian equipment is out for everyone to see. But we know that, for instance, when the stealth fighters were there, they were in hangars and old A-7 Corsair airplanes were put out for all to see. So that means if there's Russian equipment for all to see there now, then there's something in the hangars there. We just don't know what it is. They're probably testing it at night. But it's probably very, very exotic.
Is it a diversion?
The diversion is that they put stuff out
in
the daytime for people to see. You know, exactly what they're doing there at night, no one knows, but it's a very expensive place. It cost billions to build when the stealth fighters were there, air-conditioned hangars and things of that nature. And there's one thing about the government is that they don't like to start from ground zero with top-secret things. They'll go into a base where a former top-secret project was going on and just start anew there. So something was going on in Tonopah, Nevada. Even my intelligence contact said that his quote was, "In my business, everyone talks about Area 51, but no one talks about Tonopah."
And what could be happening there? Is it huge in terms of a craft?
It could be, it could be that. It could be this hypersonic vehicle that we've been hearing about for years, something that could go something on the order of 7,000 miles per hour. It could be these stealth blimps that we hear about.
What about anti-gravity?
It could be. It could be anything. And the thing is that the history of the place is that whatever is happening there, we might not know for another 10 years,
that's true.
The stealth was there and we didn't know about that for a decade.
Mac, we keep hearing stories of these large triangular-shaped objects. Is that possible out there?
Anything is possible. I mean, those large triangle objects, people are seeing them more frequently in that part of the country, that's for sure. And also these stealth blimps, which are able to kind of project the sky above onto the bottom of their fuselages. So when people look up, they think they're looking at the sky, and they're actually looking at a recreation of the sky, at night sky. Anything is possible out there.
Well, with Mac Maloney, of course, author of Beyond Area 51, you dedicate your book to a number of people we know. Nick Redfern, our dear friend, wrote your foreword. Your friend of our friend, Bill Burns. A lot of great people, Mac, have devoted a lot of their lives and careers to trying to study this.
Well, I'm just lucky since I've got into this business in the past couple of years to meet people like Nick. Nick's a great guy. Bill Burns, people like that really helped me out a lot putting this book together.
Let's talk a little bit about Colorado and the San Luis Valley. What's going on there?
Well, it's a good question. It's a valley. It's southwest of Denver. It's about 7,000 square miles, and it's a place where it's very hard to actually pin down what is going on there. I mean, UFOs are seen there all the time. And not only are they just the, let's say, standard kind of UFOs, I mean, saucer shape, but all kinds of shapes, orbs and spheres and pencil shapes and things that look like hypodermic needles and things, just crazy, crazy kind of descriptions of UFOs there. But there's also things like what people call prairie dogs, which are the people really can't see them. They just see them as kind of a that same effect that you see when there's heat over a hot roadway. This kind of distortion of the light in the air, and they almost move like they're some kind of an animal, and other animals react to them. They're called prairie dogs, and people see them out there. I think they see them out there all the time.
Hold on for a second, Mac. We'll get more into this when we roll right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, you in the mood for a little television once in a while? When you're not listening to this radio program, you can go to Beyond Belief. That's right, and watch our TV show. How do you get to it? Well, it's free for 10 days. All you have to do is go to our website, coasttocoastam.com, click hosts, and then you'll see the icon up there. Those of you who love magic, you're going to love this Friday. Brandon Scott from the Magic Castle came out to Denver. He kind of teleported, actually. So come on out and see him by going to our website, click hosts at the top, and again, the TV button, and fill out the information. You get it 10 days free and truly enjoy it. Brendan Scott, by the way, he did some things on that television show that were unbelievable. I had the editors slow it up and freeze frame it, and I still couldn't see how he made some of these things happen. Well, you'll see it when you go and take a look at it. We'll be back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Mac Maloney with us. We're talking about his latest work, Beyond Area 51. Mac, let's go back to Colorado San Luis Valley for these strange things that happened there. We'll pick it up. What have been some of the most bizarre things there?
Well, you know, we were talking about these prairie dragons that people see, these kind of invisible animals that other animals react to, dogs and cats react to these things. There's a graveyard out there where people see ghostly figures over it almost every night at a very small town out there. And they even had everyone shut off all their lights one night in this town just to see if the lights, you know, weren't a reflection of someone's front porch light or whatever. So they blacked out the town, and these ghostly lights still showed up there. I talked to someone, Christopher O'Brien, who is someone who's written several books about this place. He says it's just unbelievable. I mean, they, like, people see animals there and animal mutilations of animals that aren't even supposed to be in Colorado. They're supposed to be down in Central America. People see Bigfoot out there all the time. People have seen flying humans, which is just so strange. But police and fire department, people like that, have seen people out there flying humans. They see a lot of airplanes that seem to vanish. And here's the interesting thing about this place is that it's almost surrounded by military bases. There's a lot of U.S. military bases in Colorado. There's several out there that that do secret work, and they almost bracket the whole St. Louis Valley. So whether all these strange things out there are happening because of the military or whether the military is there because these strange things happen, we don't know. But it's a very unusual place.
Well, and you know what? That's the $64,000 question. We don't know which of the two possibilities it might be, do we?
Well, you don't know what came first. The only thing about St. Louis Valley is that we do know that for hundreds of years there was a place where a lot of Native American tribes, in fact, two entire Native American nations used to consider it a very holy place, and they would go there for their vision quests and things of that nature. So it seems like strange things have been happening out there for a while, which would make you think, well, maybe the military is there because of the strange things happening and not the other way around.
Dulce Mountain in New Mexico, something strange going on there, or tragic?
Well, I think it's more tragic than anything else. A lot of people probably know this story, but and there's a lot of people who believe that there's an alien base within Dulce Mountain.
Yeah.
The real genesis of that story is that there was a gentleman named Paul Benowitz, probably very familiar to most of your listeners, who came upon what he believed were UFOs intruding on the security of Kirtland Air Force Base, which is right outside of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and there was a lot of nuclear storage sites there. And he came upon strange signals coming over these, emanating from above these nuclear storage sites, and he also saw strange things flying around. He contacted the Air Force, this is back in the 80s now, contacted the Air Force and told them what he had found, and he thought it was UFOs, but what he had actually done was he uncovered two parallel secret projects going on, one of them having to do with how the U.S. was hiding its nuclear weapons in these storage facilities. And probably the second one was he probably saw some flights of prototype stealth fighters. But instead of the Air Force kind of taking him in, he was a physicist. He was someone who was a learned man. They should have just taken him in and said, look, sign a national security agreement and agree never to talk about this again, right, which is done hundreds of times a year, probably thousands. They instead fed him disinformation, and they steered him to his Dulce Mountain. And this is Air Force officials giving him information saying that aliens were in Dulce Mountain, that they were responsible for a lot of animal mutilations there. And this guy believed what his government was telling him. And he didn't believe that they were misinforming him or anything like that. Meanwhile, they're breaking into his house, going into his computer. And it drove him to a point where he had to be institutionalized a couple times, and he really died a broken man. So the stories of aliens being inside Dulce Mountain, you know, I cannot believe them. I don't believe them. They all really came from this, what the Air Force security people did to this poor man who was just really trying to help out. So that's why it's more of a tragic story.
He's destroyed.
They destroyed him. They literally destroyed him. And it got to the point where he was institutionalized a couple times. And even the people who did it to him, called him later in his life and said, listen, you know, we did this to you. What we told you is not true, but he still wouldn't believe them. And as I say, he died a broken man. Really, a sad story of how a government can really destroy a human being for no other reason other than that they had the power to do it.
That is sad. You have looked at the story of Jackie Gleason, one I find fascinating. He was always a friend of the late President Richard Nixon. And Jackie loved extraterrestrial stories, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He was someone who was into UFOs for a large part of his life, especially in his later years. He had a collection of 2,000 UFO books that his widow, donated to the University of Miami after he passed away. His house up in upstate New York was shaped like a flying saucer. It just fascinated him, and he wanted to know as much as he could about UFOs, flying saucers, and so on. Now, he was a good friend with Richard Nixon, which, when you really look at it, they seem like two complete opposite people.
Yeah.
Jackie Gleason was this big, boisterous entertainer, hard drinking, so on, partying all the time and so on. Nixon was this kind of reclusive type guy, but they shared golf as a love and a passion, and they used to golf a lot together when Nixon was in Key Biscayne in Florida, and Jackie owned a home south of Miami. So as the story goes, they were playing golf one day, and Gleason kind of kept his interest in UFOs below the radar a little bit because he didn't want the National Enquirer splashing him all over the front cover and so on. But he mentioned to Nixon that he was interested in. Nixon found out that he was interested in UFOs and so on. So as the story goes, one night there's a knock at Jackie Gleason's door, and it's Richard Nixon. And he's alone in a car, and he tells Gleason to come with him. They get in the car. They drive to Homestead Air Force Base. This is in the spring of 1974 when Nixon is about to be impeached. And they go into this heavily guarded hangar, and Nixon shows Jackie Gleason the remains of a flying saucer, of UFO, and also the remains of the crew. And this affected Gleason in a way. At first, he thought it was a joke because they had been talking about UFOs on the golf course earlier that day. But when he realized what he was seeing was not a joke, it affected him in a negative way. And his wife, his ex-wife, Beverly, told people later on that he was really not the same for the next month or so. He was very disturbed by what he saw. And then later on, she gave an interview to a magazine and mentioned this. They were estranged at the time. Gleason called her up right afterwards when he found out she had mentioned this magazine and ended their marriage for good. So that's how upset he was about her mentioning it.
He was livid, wasn't he?
He was livid, and that ended their marriage. People say, well, how can this be true? Like, why would Richard Nixon be driving around in a car by himself? But if you look into it a little bit, it turns out Nixon was always trying to give his Secret Service detail the slip.
Kennedy did the same thing, Mac. Whenever he was in New York, he would sneak out and go to a local bar by himself, and they'd catch him.
Right, and you always think that these people want these security people around them, but they don't, and Nixon especially didn't. So he used to go out driving by himself all the time, so it was not very unusual for him to be out driving around by himself. The end of that chapter is interesting because Jackie Gleason is in Toot Shore's restaurant in New York after this had happened, and he's trying to convince Bob Considine, who was a famous columnist at the time back then, that UFOs existed. And someone overheard their conversation, and it turned out to be this Air Force general nicknamed Rosie O'Donnell. He was someone who led the first B-29 raids on Tokyo. He was involved with the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He overheard Jackie Gleason trying to convince Bob Considine that UFOs existed, and he came over and he just kind of interrupted them gently, and he said to Considine, Jackie's right. And this is a Air Force general who was very, very high up on the food chain at the Pentagon at the time. So we thought that was an interesting way to end that chapter, that someone so high up in the Air Force and who would really be privy to these secrets was agreeing with Jackie Gleason that UFOs do exist. So that was an interesting chapter to put together.
Do you think Jackie was in shock when he saw whatever he saw?
Yes, I really do. And I don't think, if this story is true, I don't think that's the reaction that Nixon was expecting. But the bodies of the crew of this UFO, when Gleason saw them, they were in kind of a freezer. And when he looked at them at first, what he thought he was looking at were the remains of children who had been in a car accident. And then when he realized what he was looking at, he had a very negative reaction. And as we said, you know, his wife said for a month afterwards he was, you know, drinking even more than usual, and he was just it just upset him in a big way.
Yet he wanted to believe that they existed anyway, didn't he?
Right. I mean, he was someone who, you know, that's practically what he did in his spare time. He golfed and he read UFO books. He was an insomniac, so he would stay up through the night reading these books, and it was just this constant quest trying to figure it out for himself what these things might be. And then here Nixon shows him what they might be, and it had a negative effect on him. So very kind of odd outcome.
I wonder, you know, if we just polled everybody for a moment here, Mac, you know, if most of us believe that there's extraterrestrial life, some people believe we've been visited or not. But I wonder, when truly faced with looking at an extraterrestrial body, just how inspiring it might be, how awestruck we might be, how it would, you know, I don't want to say instill fear in us, but really shock, because, you know, you're looking at something from another planet. And even though your whole belief system might be geared to accepting this, I think when you first see that, it's got to be pretty emotional.
I think it'd just be a shock to your system, because think of all the information that is going to be going into your brain in that split second. As you say, you're going to be looking at something that is alive or was alive that is not of this earth, and that's just going to be something that, you know, is just going to be so much information flooding your brain that I think it would be almost impossible to have a positive reaction. I think that you'd be not repelled, but like you say, I think you'd be frightened at first, and maybe you'd be able to kind of come to terms with it. But I think the vast majority of people, I know I would. I know that if somehow or other I saw one of these gray aliens or whatever, I think I'd be frightened out of my boots.
I don't think I'd be scared, Mac, but I think I'd be in awe and shock, you know, because to be able to see it up front and personal, you know, the maybe a large gray, the big head, the big eyes, and know that whatever this thing used to be, it was alive, right, or maybe it's still alive. Who knows?
Well, your life would never be the same.
But it's not the same, and it makes your belief system change.
Right. That's right.
Probably still one of the reasons why they're not telling us anything. I really think they believe that we will be out of control if we truly believed and understood that we're not alone in the universe.
Well, that's what, you know, Winston Churchill believed that deeply. He was shown, we had a story in UFOs and Wartime, that he was shown a very distinct photo of a Foo Fighter / UFO that was following a British bomber taken in 1943. And when he saw that, he knew right away, this is not of this earth. And he said, I don't want this photo to be published for 50 years, because he believed that it would do away with all our religions, because he thought people would think, well, our religions here on earth are no good anymore, because now we know that people live in places other than the earth, and he felt that religion was the foundation of civilization, and quite it might be. So he said, do not publish this photograph for 50 years, and eventually it was destroyed. So, you know, there's a lot of kind of truth to what you say, is that if the government knew, if the government feels that we civilization, can't handle the truth, they're not going to tell us the truth. A lot of people believe that, and there's probably some truth to that.
How many Area 51 type places are there on the planet?
Well, we go to 16 different places in the book. Not all of them are military bases, but they're all close to military bases, and they all have some kind of a UFO history. There's probably somewhere between a dozen and two dozen that we know about.
All over the planet?
All over the world, yeah. Definitely all over the world.
And some of the regions would be where?
Well, Britain obviously has the Area 51, because they do as much secret testing as the United States does. In the chapter in the book, we actually try to identify where it is. There's places up in Scotland. Scotland has, you know, some people say more UFOs are spotted in Scotland than any other place in the world. There's a number of British bases up there, secret bases, certainly in Russia. Two places that we talk about in Russia. There's a place called Pine Gap, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard about, which is in the exact geographic center of Australia. It's an enormous NSA listening post that has a long history of UFO activity. There's a place called Hangyang Tang in China, which is a very strange story, how they have built the recreation of a place that's actually 2,000 miles to the west in the Himalayas, where a lot of UFO activity has been reported over the years. Any major military around the world has to have, almost has to have, some kind of a secret base to keep its secrets, you know, keep its secrets guarded against who they think their potential enemies are. So certainly throughout Europe, Russia, United States, and this American facility in Australia.
Well, what about China?
In China, yeah. China is, as I said, this place in Hengyantang. It's very strange. They built, the Chinese military built an exact recreation of this place called Aksai Chin, which is on the border of India and China. And it's a place where they actually had a war in 1962, India and China, over this very isolated place in the Himalayas. No one is really sure why they had this war. It happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis, so not many people knew what was going on at the time. But the people there see UFOs all the time. In fact, some researchers went there and they asked the children in this region, draw what you see every day, and half of these kids drew UFOs. People see UFOs there all the time. The Chinese and the Indian military keep people away from this particular area. No one knows why the Chinese government or military built this scale model, huge scale model of this region of the Himalayas, and they don't know whether it's for military training or what, but they just happen to build this scale model of a place where a lot of UFOs are seen 2,000 miles west of its location. I know it sounds strange, but, you know, what the Chinese do is, you know, people, you know, there are people in the government whose full-time job is just trying to figure out why the Chinese do things.
Well, that could be, too. Well, Mac, I got to tell you, you've done a great job here. I want to continue talking about some of these very strange places that are out there. You had mentioned before the break, can we get in this Saddam's Area 51? What did he have going?
Well, this is a story we first got into in UFOs in wartime, but there's been this story around that his anti-aircraft forces shot down a UFO in the late 90s, and they brought it to a place in the Little Zab River Valley, a place called Zasi. And that's where he supposedly had his own Area 51. And we tracked down this story where some people think that they reverse-engineered something on this UFO and made this kind of fantastic extraterrestrial weapon of mass destruction. And maybe that's what the whole invasion of Iraq in 2003 was about. It's kind of a stretch, but as in UFOs in wartime, we came upon stories that were just too good not to put in the book, and this was one of them. And it turns out that at the beginning of the invasion in 2003, that one of the places the U.S. military concentrated on was this Little Zab River Valley, where his Area 51 was supposed to be. A lot of special operations happened there in the opening days of the war. You know, could we have started that war just to get this extraterrestrial WMD away from him? We didn't find anything else over there. So, you know, maybe, who knows, maybe there's a little bit of truth to that story. I don't know. But it's an interesting story, nevertheless.
Mac, when we come back, let's talk also a little bit about your previous work, UFOs in Wartime. And then we'll put it all together, and later on we'll take some phone calls with you right here on Coast to Coast AM.